Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee meeting. Unfortunately, Chair Fagan has another commitment for the first few minutes here. And the agenda will be as follows. We'll have public hearings on House Bill 2850 and House Bill 2250, followed by an anticipated work session on House Bill 2258, and if time, then an informational meeting on qualified rehabilitation facilities and employment for individuals with disabilities. I'd now like to open a...
Yeah, so you can go either way, but just make sure.
Okay. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2850.
So, Madam Chair and members, a summary of House Bill 2850. The measure provides that a notice of lapse of an individual life, long-term care, or disability insurance policy is not effective until the unless the insurer sends written notice to the policy owner at least 25 days before the lapse date and includes explanation of the reasons for the lapse. The bill specifies methods for sending notice and what constitutes proof of notice. Becomes operative January 1st, 2016. The bill declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. It's been found to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. There is a dash 3 amendment that's been proposed, which makes a few changes to, I think, changes the lapse notice rate day to period to 30 days, and also specifies a number of things about how the notice should be given.
Well said.
Representative
Thank you, Vice
Huffman.
Chair, Vice Chair Buehler. Committee members, John Huffman, representative for House District 59. And would it be okay if we invited Elise Brown and Tom Simpson up to
Absolutely.
Join me?
Please
They'll
do.
Be really filling in the meat of it. I just wanted to give you a little bit of background as to how we came here with House Bill 2850. I have a constituent and his wife that have had a long-term care disability, or not disability, long-term care policy for two or three decades that they've had regularly paid on. At some point last year, they didn't get their quarterly invoice, and they didn't think about it, and they didn't get a potential lapse of notice. They didn't get any notifications until they got the cancellation notice. And so they got the cancellation notice, they got on the phone, tried to contact the insurance company, which is Unum. I don't mind saying their name on the record. Because in my work with this, I found a lot of other very responsive insurance companies that are like, wow, it's too bad that happened. But they called and talked to the person that answered the phone. They put them in touch with the next supervisor, who put them in touch with the next supervisor. And you can imagine what went on from there. The bottom line was the company said, oh, I'm sorry, it's too late. You got the cancellation notice. We can't back the truck up. That's the point that they contacted me. I know none of you guys have ever been in that situation where you've been contacted by a constituent about anything like this. So I called the insurance commissioner, and we got the state agency working on it. And within 2 to 3 months, the policy was reinstated, and everything went along probably as it should have been several months earlier. So that's what happened to bring us to this point. We wanted to try to craft a bill so that there would be some language in state policy directing insurance companies on how to send out lapse notices, when to send them out, and the important part, which allows for the policyholder to name a designee so that they would also receive notices. And you'll see, I forget the paragraph number, but it says, and designee instead of or designee, so that they'll all receive the notices. So it's kind of a fail-safe so that this might not happen again. And so with more detailed explanation as to how the language was crafted after the national standards by NAIC, which National Association of Insurance
Commissioners
is the language that has been adopted nationally, and that's what we're using here. So thank you very much for your time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans, National Trade Association. So we are here now to support House Bill 2850 with the Dash 3 amendments. It was a pleasure to work with Rep. Huffman, and in our dealings, understanding his constituents' issue and how we could actually make the bill better, it was pointed out that NAIC, through all of its good work in putting together model legislation that all states can use to be uniform, we made the bill better by doing a couple things. We used a 30-day rather than 25, so it gives the consumer an additional 5 more days notice before a lapse to occur. And then the second thing that Rep. Huffman just referred to was the last known electronic mail address for the policyholder and designee. So at this place, it allows for safeguard, so somebody in substitute would be notified. So that, we think, with those improvements, it makes the bill even better for consumers, and here to support. So thank you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Buehler, members of the committee, my name is Tom Simpson. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Standard Insurance. For those who may not remember, Standard is based in Portland, Oregon, has been there for over 100 years. We have about 1,100 Oregon employees. Our section of this bill is really around individual disability, which actually Oregon and California are two largest blocks of that business because we've been here for so long. Our only concern about the bill is how one defines the lapse date. And for the purposes of this discussion, I want to make sure, and I want to get on the record, that we believe the lapse date is the date that we would drop coverage. There's lots of places, as you get a bill and it says your due date is this, and then you call up and you say, hey, I need another 15 days, and then you say, and they say, great, we'll give you some more time. What date was actually that due? Well, that bounces around. As long as they get their money, then they're good, and you're good, and your coverage continues. In our case, that would be the same thing. We really want to retain customers. We have no real interest in dropping you just because you may be a couple days late. So for our purposes, the lapse date would be the date that we would drop the coverage, which may be out quite a ways because of an agreement we may have made with the policyholder.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and Elise can talk to, I just wanted to throw in, we are in agreement with the definition that the standard is using to define that. So.
Representative Rayfield?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, how far in your definition of a lapse date, if a lapse date, say, is 160 days out, right? And so those, is someone at 160 days, would they have to then pay a full amount of that, whatever those premiums were for those 160 days, to make the policy go current? If so, that may make things very difficult for someone who was unaware that they were had lapsed that long. And so I just kind of just wanted to throw that out for a comment.
Sure. Vice Chair Buehler, Vice Chair Rayfield. I hate to say it depends, but somewhat does. But what would typically happen in that case, and this is my understanding, is that there may be a period that you, if we brought you current, that's a big check, right? Mm-hmm. We could arrange with you just to start paying again, but you would have a period of non-coverage. So you would not be period. So if let's say 3 months went by that you didn't pay, and we could start you again on, say, the original due date was July. There was a lapse in there somewhere, and then also we got you going again in November. There may be some stipulations we have to put on that, but we would bring you back in. You could get going again, but that period in between there may be a period where you weren't covered. But in this particular case, because it's individual disability, you're likely going to be okay.
Okay, just one quick follow-up.
Yep, sure.
If someone has a policy that, say, every month, they fail to make their payment on, let's say the payment is due on June 1st every month, so the first of every month, and let's say on March 1st they fail to make their payment, okay, and let's say March 15th they want to make a claim on their policy. What would the insurance company do? My general impression would be is if you fail to make your payment on March 1st, when March 15th rolls around, I then, as an insurer, because it can sit there and say, sorry, Charlie, you didn't make your payment on March 1st. We will not honor that claim on March 15th. But however, you can renew on April 1st and we'll start over. That just happens to be the lapse period. So I just kind of, again, how does that work?
Sure, Vice Chair Buehler, Vice Chair Rayfield. So in this particular instance, let me give you an example because we've kind of sketched this out because the dates are, we're trying to figure out when would be the lapse date. And it's about a quarterly payment policy. So a monthly,
okay.
but it
Fair
may
enough.
Work. But on a quarterly payment, let's say your due date was originally July 1st. Under Oregon law, you've got I'm going to make sure I get the words right, statutory grace period of 31 days. So if you didn't pay on July 1st, you've got 31 days that you're fine because you've still got 31 days. At that point, we notify you, if we haven't got anything, we notify you again and say, yo, time's up. But then we also give them more time after that. So if they were to call us and say, hey, I need more time, it just depends on the situation at that point, but we'd actually notify. So, but right under my understanding of Oregon law right now is you actually have a statutory window of 31. I don't know if that applies to month by month, but for this particular case, it's quarterly.
And just last follow up, two things. Do you normally say yo in your letter? Second thing, when you under the July 1st example, when would the lapse date be by which you would send that 30-day notice?
So, Vice Chair Buehler, Vice Chair Rayfield, right now would be what I'm saying is when we actually would drop the coverage. So in that window, there's due dates because we've moved it out. But I would say that for this conversation, the termination date or the lapse date would be when you're just no longer covered with the standard.
Mm-hmm. But what date would that be?
So in this instance, July 1st was the original due date. Say for this example, it would be out on or around August 15th or further out.
And so if it's August 15th. And they have a 31-day grace period, then there would be 15 days where they wouldn't have coverage then.
So it was a 31-day, so from 7-1 to 8-1, there's your 31 days. We gave them another 15 days, and at that point, again, it depends on the situation. That's a 45 days from their original due date.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your notice would go out on July 15th?
On or about, correct.
Okay.
Mr. Vice Chair, just quickly, I don't recall if I said or not. I may not have because of Vice Chair Rayfield's questions. My constituent's situation, and I think from what I understand in working on this bill, it's fairly common for these to be quarterly paid, and that was the situation with my constituents. When they got reinstalled, they paid 6 months worth of premium mm-hmm. to be reinstated. So I think quarterly is kind of the common scenario.
Any further questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2850, and I see Representative Nathanson in the back room. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2250.
Unless you wanted to wait.
Hate to have to wait.
Madam Chair and members, a summary of House Bill 2250. That this measure authorized the Department of Administrative Services, or DAS, to adopt rules relating to electronic fingerprint capture. The bill directs DAS to adopt rules establishing factors to be considered when making fitness determinations and appealing fitness determinations. It applies laws requiring use of uniform rules regarding making of fitness determinations to state agencies and entities currently exempt from such rules. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2016. It declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. It has been found to have no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact, but the statement has not yet been issued. There's a dash one amendment that makes relatively minor changes, including correcting the reference to the Oregon Health Authority and clarifying some language relative to criminal background checks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, a representative from District 13. Dozens of occupations in the private and public sector require a criminal background check. Home care workers, school employees, dentists, physicians, bus drivers, counselors, therapists, escrow agents, dentists, funeral service providers, and even volunteers, people volunteering for certain kind of activities in certain settings. Someone who works at a school, let's say part-time, or who drives a bus, and to make ends meet, also has a second, maybe even a third job. Maybe they provide care for a senior or provide daycare after hours or on weekends. Let's say they also want to volunteer at a child's school, on a, you know, volunteer with a team or for some kind of activity. That's three separate background checks for that person. And unfortunately, someone working in the same occupation, the very same occupation, but for different businesses operating in a different county, the county next door, that creates an additional need for a background check, and that's additional work and expense. This expense adds up to another burden on nonprofit organizations, local businesses, schools, and others, and of course, it's expense and burden and time for the applicant or the volunteer. In addition to this, there's often differing criteria for passing or failing a background check. Those criteria aren't necessarily consistent across clusters of occupations. For example, persons working with children, persons working with seniors, persons working with financial records. Consistency in fitness determinations across these occupation clusters would help align and normalize or standardize the criteria. In 2013, the legislature heard a set of bills to streamline the criminal background check process. Two of those passed and are already being implemented. The electronic or digital fingerprinting is already being rolled out throughout the state, and the voluntary registry, which can be used for a background check when applying for other jobs, has been designed and it's in the process of being implemented. The third bill that passed is the one that this bill would help implement. The third bill that passed in 2013 was around the objective of portability, or making that background check portable from one job to another. It means we can avoid repeating background checks to apply for the same job but a different employer, or a similar job, or a different job but requirements that were even more stringent than the one you're applying for, but nevertheless you still have to have another background check. That 2013 bill launched a process to standardize as much as possible the criteria that are being used to evaluate an applicant's background. This bill is simply another step to help implement that process that has been underway for a while. DAS has convened meetings over the past year or more. They've been meeting with stakeholders, and they have identified some statutory changes that will help with this standardization effort. And I believe there's two amendments available that you can consider, and we hope that you do. As we streamline background checks and set up a system that's more efficient and cost-effective, we're going to save money for nonprofit organizations, save money for employers, save money for the applicants. And think of all the agencies, the schools, and the nonprofit organizations where it will help for children, seniors, and other Oregonians. We've even heard stories about the time delay that's imposed on organizations waiting to employ someone. There's someone who needs help, who needs a home care worker, for example, and sometimes it takes several weeks to get a background check, which, as it turns out, was not necessarily needed. It would have been a redundant background check, but they're still obligated by statute to run a new background check, and to wait weeks while someone is waiting for help in their home is really unfortunate. So I hope that you will consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Okay.
Thank you, Representative. Next witness is Twyla Lawson.
Vice Chair Bueller and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Lawson, and I am a senior human resources consultant with the Chief Human Resources Office within the Department of Administrative Services. I have been assigned to implement the requirements of the three bills that passed from the 2013 session related to criminal records checks for licensure and employment purposes. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today, and my plan is to provide you a brief background on the work that's been completed thus far, and then explain the language in House Bill 2250 from a high level, and then answer any questions you may have. It is a lot of information, so I will try and keep it high level, but please do let me know if you have any questions. I also would like to say I've been informed by the Oregon Health Care Association, SEIU, and AFSCME that they are very supportive of this legislation. This process has involved a lot of key stakeholders. We've had stakeholders drive up on a monthly basis from the Rogue Valley to participate in the work that's been done so far. So it's been very involved with a very diverse group of people. So I did give you a handout. I hope you all have it. It's a two-page handout. And there is some over on the table if there's anyone in attendance that would like to see it. So my hope was to just walk through this handout, if that's okay with you, and then take any questions. Yes?
There's the handout is online.
It is online. I do have hard copies here, too, if you... Okay. So first, I wanted to start with 2014. In 2014, you passed a bill. It was House Bill 4091. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Got to get that one mistake out of the way, and then the rest will be perfect. Okay, in 2012, let's start 2012 on the first page. House Bill 4091 was passed, and what House Bill 4091 did was require DAS to create a work group to consider criminal background checks as a single statewide system to evaluate the potential for any improvements of timeliness, cost, and duplication of clearance. So those things that Representative Nathanson spoke about, 4091 was to look at how those things could be improved. And then in November 2012, as required by House Bill 4091, a report was provided that included recommendations on what could be done to improve criminal background checks in this area. So then in 2013, there were four bills that went before the legislature related to this effort. The first one was House Bill 3330, and it is the one that required the electronic capture and submission of fingerprints. It also required the creation by DAS of a statewide contract to electronically capture and submit prints in the state of Oregon for employment, licensing, and volunteers that access Oregon State Police data. It's very specific on who it involves, access Oregon State Police data for this purpose. And it also required these same agencies to conduct a study related to their criminal background check processes and report in October of 2015. Then the second bill that passed was House Bill 3331. And what 3331 did was when someone has their criminal background check run, they can elect to, if they have a clean history, be put into a registry. And so essentially the person says in advance, if I have no history in my criminal background, I would like to be in the registry. And then what the bill did is it said, post-offer, so once an offer's been made, that licensing entity or employer could say, by chance, are you in the registry? And if they were in the registry, that could prevent a repeat fingerprint check. So that's what House Bill 3331 did. And that has been created. We're still working on streamlining it into the electronic fingerprint process. But right now, there is an application process, and it's administered by Oregon State Police. The third bill that passed was House Bill 3168. And what 3168 did, the easiest way for me to explain it to you is, in history, each state agency, an entity, got authority that was required by the federal government. And then with that authority, they were required to create their own rules to implement criminal background checks. So historically, everybody had their own rules. So then ultimately, eventually, you have this big set of rules that's program specific. Right? So if I work at a certain agency, this is my criminal background check. Well, what 3168 did is it said it's actually not program specific. There should be one set of rules, and those rules should be based on the direct access to a certain population. So direct access to a child, direct access to an elderly person, a person with a disability. So that's what 3168 did. And so part of what we've spent the time since 3168 passed doing is trying to figure out what other things are there in current law that make that so that getting those things changed might make it to be able to be fully implemented with the original legislation. So that was 3168. And then the fourth bill related to the work of House Bill 4091 was House Bill 2828. And what 2828 did is it made steps towards the creation of a wrap-back system. And we'll talk about a wrap-back system a little bit more, but that was the initial bill that would have created a wrap-back system, and that bill did not pass. Okay, so then we go, that was 2013, and then we go to 2014 on the second page at the top. In 2014, September, I came before this committee and presented the report that was required in House Bill 3330, and it gave an update on the three bills and where they, what had been accomplished at that point, and then it also gave a report by each agency on them reviewing their process and where they were able to streamline or improve things. So that was done in 2014. In 2014, we created the electronic fingerprint capture contract, statewide contract. We drafted, went through the procurement process, finalized it in July of 2014, and since July of 2014, we've been implementing it with the Fieldprint contract vendor. That was the vendor that was selected for that contract, and we're working with them to implement that with each entity across the state. So that does, there are a lot of different organizations involved, so we're project managing with them on getting that implemented. And then the registry that was was required by House Bill 3331 was created in 2014 and is still in process of being streamlined. And then we kicked off in November, we kicked off the work of House Bill 3168. So that has involved we have one primary work group of about 15 members and then seven subgroups based on the population. So a group, a very diverse group of people that work with children, a diverse group of people that work with the elderly, and so forth. So what House Bill, this is the bill that's before you today, House Bill 2250. It does a number of things. The first thing that it does is it does some things for two of the bills, actually, House Bill 3330, the one that required the electronic capture and submission of prints. That bill has exception authority for hard card prints. So if someone was in a unique circumstance and they needed to be able to provide hard card prints, 3330 gave Oregon State Police the authority to grant that exception. But the challenge there is Oregon State Police is also a provider of electronic prints. So one of the things that 2250 does is it says that that exception can go to DAS, who also owns the statewide contract. But as you can see, that does, there's a challenge there with the exception authority being with someone who provides the prints themselves. Then it also lays out uniform rules for fitness determination. Fitness determination is the description of the process that you go through for a background check. The law currently has that description in multiple places, so it cleans it up so that it can be in rule in one place. And it just does some other cleanup language and repeals some ORS language that that creates it. So where we have, there's some statutory language that deals with certain populations, but it's only for that program and that population. So it causes you not to be able to have uniform rules for each population. So there's some of the challenges there. And then I also put on here, just so you had it, House Bill 2228. It is the wrap-back bill. There's actually two bills. But 2228 is based on arrest, which when the work group did their work, that was one of the things they looked at, was the federal program on the electronic capture and submission of prints. And this was where the fingerprints are retained. And I did bring, or I asked someone else to come who is actually the primary on the wrap back if there's any questions on that one. So I think that concludes what I wanted to share with you, and then if you have any questions for me.
Questions? Representative
Queen? Me? Okay. Well, I'm late to the game because, I mean, you've been working on this for thousands of years here, evidently. You know, this is very concise, and I appreciate your handout. It's really good. You know, I have to do more research on this. I'm sure there's always a good reason for all of this, and I know that our representative that started this off indicated that it's going to save money and that workers are approving of it. But the image that came to my mind was just the newborn baby, and we take their fingerprints and we stamp them on the head. You know, I mean, it's just one of those things where it feels like when you have these large venues of information, that it creates, you know, issues with privacy and issues with a lot of different things. And so I admire your goals. I admire the tenacity behind this this group of working bills and items. But I guess I feel like, you know, when you look at the amount of statutes that it mm-hmm. affected, and the amount of statutes that are listed there, I mean, there's a lot of them here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just going back and checking and rechecking to make sure that we don't have, you know, conflicting, you know, types of statements going on for different agencies to be doing mm-hmm. different things. And then your last statement about the exception, you know, the person who's actually doing the work is then the person that, you know, is kind of the check and balance for the program, right? They get the exception. Is that correct, that last item?
Well, Representative McLean and members of the committee, when I'm talking about the exception, for that was for hard card prints.
Okay.
So if somebody like, we're actually working on trying to implement the electronic fingerprints nationwide. So if somebody applied to be a licensee from another state, that they could actually be captured. But it's really like, so if somebody from another state mm-hmm. needed to get their prints taken, that in rule we could grant exceptions, like if there was a geographic area that made it so they couldn't get electronic fingerprints, mm-hmm. that an exception could be granted for that, for mm-hmm. for the print capture to be ink.
Okay. Well, anyway, so I'm quite sure you guys are all more prepared on this issue, but it's interesting, and I continue to have an open mind.
Representative Rayfield.
Yeah, and I don't know if the amendments cover this, but in the testimony against us, the Oregon State Bar noted that it eliminates the contested hearing requirement, and so basically by removing that, there is not a statutory right for the contested case mm-hmm. hearing. And so I just, you know, and I may have missed that in your presentation, and I looked at the amendment, and I didn't see anything, you know, at least the amendment that I have, the dash one, it didn't seem to be applicable, so I just wanted to have you address that.
Absolutely. Vice Chair Bueller, Representative Rayfield, I'll tell you, I found out about that yesterday and immediately got on the phone and talked to our council, and we were able to actually add six words in an amendment is on page 2. And I spoke to the Bar Association, and they said that it solved it for them. It was never the intent to change any appeal rights. So what we proposed was adding on line 40 at the very end of the sentence, except as otherwise provided by law. And they were very comfortable with that because there was never an intent to change current appeal rights that are in law.
And so that we don't have, is that going to be a new amendment that we're going to do here?
It's on.
I only have the dash one, so I don't have.
Representative Rayfield and members of the committee, it is posted online, but it was posted just, I think, a couple of hours before the meeting, okay. So you may not have the hard copy
yet.
Dash two.
It's dash two. Yes. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
As a person that's followed this issue from its inception, I just want to compliment Twyla and all the people that worked on this. I attended some of these meetings as it went along the process, and really it was a very broad group of stakeholders and all the different agencies participating in trying to make this work. And really the fundamental purpose of this is really a huge streamlining effort that will help save not just the state, but a lot of nonprofits and a lot of individuals who have to get the background checks a lot of money, for one, without jeopardizing any of the issues. And I know the ACLU has been very involved in following this process through all the way through, because they had some huge concerns, especially about the RAP back, which I think was one of the reasons it didn't get implemented sooner. So, and I think, you know, a lot of those challenges have been met in this process, and just really compliment the agencies and Twyla specifically and Representative Nathanson for sticking to it on this all the way through the process.
So, any other questions? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. I close the public hearing on 2250 and open an informational meeting on qualified rehabilitation facilities. And I see the good Senator Sarah Gelsler here. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Buehler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelsler. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, Tangent, Millersburg, and unincorporated areas of Linn and Benton County. I was asked to come today to provide a little bit of context around the discussion of employment of people with disabilities. This is an issue that has received a lot of attention lately. There are a lot of terms and organizations that are involved, and sometimes they get a little bit confusing and mixed up. So I wanted to start by describing a little bit about why this issue is important and what the difference is between different organizations. So the first thing is that this is an information hearing largely about qualified rehabilitation facilities. Qualified rehabilitation facilities are organizations that exist in order to provide employment opportunities for people with disabilities. Some of the work that is provided through QRFs, qualified rehabilitation facilities, is done for at or above minimum wage. It may be done in a community setting where people with disabilities work alongside people that don't have disabilities. In some cases, some of the work that's done in a QRF may be done in a sheltered workshop or in an enclave or in a cohort of people that go out and do work together, all people with disabilities that are supervised. Not all QRFs are sheltered workshops, and not all sheltered workshops are QRFs. Sheltered workshops are organizations that are created solely to employ people with disabilities, and the people without disabilities that are there are employed primarily to supervise or support the people with disabilities that are working in the organization. That is something, that is a definition that is separate and distinct from a QRF, and that is just a really important thing to keep in mind, that they are not one and the same. One of the reasons that this issue has been receiving a great deal of attention lately is that there are two things that have happened in Oregon over the course of the last 2 years. The first is that there was a lawsuit that was brought against the state, a class action lawsuit on behalf of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, who argued that our state employment dollars were disproportionately being used to put people inside sheltered workshops. Again, that's separate, distinct from a QRF, but inside sheltered workshops without opportunities to develop skills to work in more competitive, less segregated environments. And some of the lead plaintiffs in that case were able to talk about employment that they had previously had in the community and being put back in sheltered workshops and being denied the opportunity to have the supports to seek gainful employment outside of that sheltered place. As that lawsuit is working its way through the court system, system, the federal court ruled that the Olmstead ruling, which had to do with integration in housing and deinstitutionalization, also applies to employment, that a state cannot disproportionately prioritize funding for employment in segregated or sheltered workshops at the expense of supporting people to gain the skills that they need to work in the community alongside non-disabled community members at or above the minimum wage for competitive wages. As that was moving through, and the executive branch would tell you it is not related to the lawsuit, but coincidentally, around the same time, there was an executive order on employment that said that Oregon would start focusing more on providing appropriate employment supports for people with disabilities and focusing more on integrated employment for individuals. Part of that focus would be on young people with disabilities of transition age, and transition age is about 16 to 24. Starting to develop opportunities and training for these individuals to be able to enter the competitive workplace. One of the rules that came out of that is that you can no longer go directly from school directly into a sheltered workshop without having the opportunity to look for more integrated employment. So that is why we are paying attention. My interest in this is multifold. The first is that I am the parent of a 20-year-old young man who will be 21 this year who experiences intellectual and developmental disabilities. He is an individual that's directly impacted by this executive order. We have sat through meetings with vocational rehabilitation, developmental disabilities, and the school district as we work on creating an employment path for him. And I can tell you, as a consumer and a parent, I am deeply grateful for this executive order and the new opportunities that it is offering for my son to develop his own skills so that he will hopefully be able to live and work independently in the community despite and because of the significant needs that he has related to his disability. The other interest that I have in this issue is that I've served for several years, my term just ended, as a member of an organization called the National Council on Disability. Our members are, and I'm not speaking on behalf of NCD, I'm speaking on behalf of myself, but members of the National Council on Disability are nominated by the president and confirmed by a vote of the U.S. Senate, and our job is to advise the president and Congress and agencies about the implementation of programs and laws related to the advancement of people with disabilities. In 2012, I was part of a subgroup that took up the issue of subminimum wage and employment of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. What we were interested in was a federal rule that's called 14C that allows organizations that have these certificates to pay people with disabilities less than minimum wage. We came at it from the perspective that a minimum wage is a minimum wage. All people deserve the dignity of work, and it does not make sense to pick out a person with a developmental disability, hold them to what is essentially a higher standard by doing these productivity tests and pay them less than the minimum wage. So what we wanted to do was really study the issue. Our team visited seven different states. We visited with sheltered workshops. We visited with supported employment providers that provided employment in the community. We met with people with disabilities that were very young, like my son. We met with people with disabilities who were nearing retirement age. We went into sheltered workshops. We went into all sorts of different environments to come up with a proposal. One of the things that quickly became clear to us was that I'm just going to read from our response here. The committee recognized early that any statement of public policy or recommendation to simply eliminate all Section 14C certificates would jeopardize the security of many individuals who are currently involved with the program. The committee thus concluded that a transformation strategy was needed to phase out a policy relic from the 1930s, when discrimination was inevitable because service systems were based on a charity model rather than empowerment and self-determination. NCD stands for the principle that no person with a disability should be discriminated against in an employment setting by paying less than the minimum wage available to all other citizens. And I would take that a step further, that we also shouldn't be putting people into sheltered workshops. During our work, and I wanted to share some of this with you, we found some key findings about the impact of supported employment at sheltered workshops, outcomes, and cost effectiveness of these different employment strategies. Sheltered workshops are ineffective at transitioning individuals with disabilities to integrated
related employment. According to the 2001 investigation by the Government Accountability Office into 14C programs, only 5% of sheltered workshop employees ever leave to take a job into the community. So when we take kids at the age of 20, 21, take them out of school and put them into a sheltered workshop, they are likely to stay in that sheltered workshop for the rest of their lives. Just as when we put people into Fairview, until we closed Fairview, they were likely to stay at Fairview for the rest of their lives. When they're in these places, they are often not performing tasks that are consistent with their skills or their passions. It is a dead-end job where they are stuck. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Medicaid-financed pre-vocational services to sheltered workshops are, quote, not an endpoint, but a time-limited service for the purpose of helping someone obtain competitive employment. So the funding that we receive from the federal government is not intended to permanently put somebody into a sheltered workshop. Individuals in supported employment who had previously been served in sheltered workshop settings do not show a higher rate of employment as compared to those who had gone straight to supported employment without ever being in a sheltered workshop. However, those who had previously been in sheltered workshops had higher support costs and lower wages than comparable individuals who had never been in sheltered workshop settings. We also found that 14C subminimum wage programs are utilized primarily by nonprofit or state-operated social service programs, and 95% of the workers in these sheltered workshops are being paid less than minimum wage. And research indicates that employees receiving supported employment services generate lower cumulative costs than employees receiving sheltered workshop services, and that whereas the cost trend of supported employees shifts downward over time, the opposite is the case for people that are in sheltered workshops. My position is that ultimately there is an economic case to be made for supported employment, where we look at the skills and strengths that individuals have, and there's also a human argument to be made for that. It is simply inappropriate to force people into sheltered workshops that are segregated and do not empower people to become more independent. One of the things that's really important to keep in mind in this conversation, however, is that organizations that are offering sheltered workshops are organizations that just 20 and 30 years ago were very progressive, cutting-edge organizations serving people with disabilities. These are great organizations and great people who have been working really hard on behalf of people with disabilities. The job that we have now, as we have a new generation of people coming of age with intellectual and developmental disabilities, this group of people has a different expectation for their future. They expect to be able to make their own choices. They expect to be able to choose whether or not they want to get married. They expect to be able to choose what type of job they want to have and where they want to work. And they expect that they will be treated as equals with all of the other adults in their community, so that if I can expect to earn minimum wage in a job, a person with Down syndrome can also expect to earn minimum wage in that job. Our job is to seek that transition moving forward. You'll hear a lot of conversation today about how we can make sure that these organizations are performing in the best interests of individuals with disabilities. I know there's a lot of conversation in this building about the executive order and whether or not that will leave people with disabilities trapped and with nothing to do. As the parent of one of these individuals that does have significant needs, I can tell you I am tremendously grateful for the executive order. And the same arguments that are being made about this transition that we're making employment are the exact same arguments that were made when we closed Fairview. And if you go back and you talk to any person that lived at Fairview, they will tell you how much they treasure their freedom, how much they treasure their independence, and how much they never want to go back to a place where they lived under the watchful eye of guards that did not allow them to choose what they ate, when they got up in the morning, what the temperature of their shower was, or what they could wear when they got dressed every day. This is essentially a civil rights issue that's about whether or not every single one of us is equal, every single one of us should have the opportunity to pursue our passion, or whether we choose to say there are some people that we're going to put aside in a place that's hidden, we're going to pay them less than anyone else, and we're not going to really focus on their strengths. For me, it's deeply personal because I look at my son, I know that he's equal, I know that he has deep capacity. I treat him the same as I do my siblings, and I expect the state of Oregon to treat him in the same way they do all of their other citizens. So I'm grateful you're having this conversation, and I hope as we move forward, we can all work to make sure that we
underscore the dignity and rights of all people, including those with developmental and intellectual disabilities, and that we can make this critical transition in employment, recognizing the federal court ruling that non-discrimination and segregation or desegregation mandates apply to employment in the same way as they do to housing. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So thanks for your testimony, Senator Gelser. I share some of your passion on these issues, too. I've been to QRFs, and I know the difference between a sheltered workshop and a QRF, and I appreciate that. I was not born with that knowledge, but I did get that. One of the things that's coming up, we're all sitting on the edge of our seats waiting to have the minimum wage debate, and one of the things that I hear about the minimum wage is that it's going to cause unemployment. And I would just throw out to you just the idea of that when you have people that are not the leading cutting edge. You have developmentally disabled people. They're not the cutting edge of the employable people. Isn't raising the minimum wage, isn't that going to take a bite out of their opportunities for employment?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, I believe that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are much like people without intellectual and developmental disabilities. Some are going to be very strong workers that are very competitive in the work environment, and some are going to need some more help and encouragement. I do support an increase in the minimum wage. I also support making sure that we aren't paying people pennies an hour. In this state, Goodwill, for instance, pays people pennies an hour while their CEO is the highest paid nonprofit person in the country, and I don't, because my family's not allowed to shop there, give things to them to make that profit off the backs of people with disabilities. So I think we absolutely have to change that.
Can I follow?
Yes.
Thanks. I share your outrage, if I can use that word, at Goodwill. And this, I have the same issue with some of the other QRFs that I've had experience with, that who gets to decide what the pay grade is worth or whatever, and I share your outrage at some of that I've seen. When you talk about the sheltered workshops, I think there's the same kind of issue there. I'm in agreement with you that what this is about human dignity. That's what we're talking about, and we need to maximize that for these people, especially these people. And I worry that the reason that we have sheltered workshops is because we have people that are so disabled that they're not able to do that. And the sheltered workshop is their freedom. That is their promised land that they go to. And if you were to take that away, they're not going to be able to go to in the open market, a QRF. And so I worry that if you take away the sheltered workshop, the guy who can't go into the open market and get a job, even as in a QRF, is going to end up being put into a less freedom situation of having to be at home and not have the dignity of having even that job in a sheltered workshop. What would you say to that?
Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, first of all, thank you for bringing up that point. It's a very important one. In this conversation, I think one of the places that we get hung up is getting kind of mixed up between different service elements that might be available to support individuals with developmental and intellectual disabilities. Employment is employment. I believe that when we're spending employment dollars, state public employment dollars, those should be used in the most cost-effective and evidence-based way to develop job skills for people so that they can go to work. That does not mean that we should be getting rid of day habilitation programs or respite programs or day activity programs. It's very, very important that individuals have things to do during the day that are meaningful to them, that give them an opportunity to be engaged in the community and with other people. It's one of the reasons why I serve on the governor's executive order policy task force. One of the things many of us have asked for is that we keep track of not just the number of people that we're increasing that are in supported employment, but we also want to keep track of who's not getting served anymore. We want to make sure we're not leaving anybody at home. And we've seen success at this. Vermont, for instance, is operating no 14C certificates and no sheltered workshops at all in the state of Vermont. And their individuals are being served. They are not sitting at home all day staring at a wall.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Senator.
And Madam Chair, may I make one more point?
Yes.
Because I would be remiss. I think one of the things that's important on that minimum wage question to keep in mind is that for many of these QRFs, they're nonprofits. So when I talk about a transition, we have to be working with these organizations to be able to continue serving the individuals that they're sharing, because you're looking at having to go out and fundraise a bunch of money to make up for that. One of the ways that I've proposed that, it's in Senate Bill 555, would look at the first step, making sure that when we, as public entities, are purchasing services from a QRF, that all of the individuals working on those products or projects are making at least the minimum wage. But rather than putting that fiscal burden on these nonprofits who are working very hard to serve these individuals and have been great advocates for people with disabilities, we put that burden back on ourselves in that negotiation of those contracts, that those increased wages would be there. And that is a really important thing. For me, the issue of human dignity and the right to a minimum wage and the right to integrated employment is absolute. How we get there is a transition, and being respectful of all of the people that are engaged and have been engaged in this work for several decades is really important. There are no bad guys in this. You just have a lot of people working to support individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and advocate for them, and that's something that's really special about Oregon, is the way that everybody works together in the community to do that, and I'm grateful for that.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, next we're going to have Darvin Pierce and Diane Lancaster.
Chair Fagan, representatives of the committee, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services, and I have with me Darvin Pierce, who is the coordinator for the QRF program that we administer. We have some visuals, and I'm going to speak briefly to what we are charged to do and what the program history is about. And I think you have this online, and it's a colored sheet. The first piece that I was going to draw your attention to is a colored sheet, and it says 2014 QRF program information. So if you might draw your attention to that, I'll just show a few highlights of that. And I want many thanks to Senator Geltzer's presentation. I think that really helped set some of the context of the information we're going to provide to you. The QRF program was authorized by the Oregon Legislature in 1977, so it is now 38 years old. Department of Administrative Services has always been charged with the administration of this program, and it is a program that is a set-aside from ordinary competitive contract work. So the contracts that are achieved through this program are negotiated. The policy has always been that we are to support maximum independence for disabled individuals through useful and productive employment. The program applies to all state and public, local public agencies, so, you know, all government levels are affected. And currently there are over 4,000 disabled Oregonians who are having some form of part-time or full-time employment from the program. If you look towards the bottom of that first page, it shows you some of the new and expanded products and services, and we have, in our next little bit of handout, we have a map that shows you where these facilities are located, and I think you'll see that it's kind of an interesting picture. On the back of this page, or on page two, whichever you're doing, if you're looking at it online, there are some statistics that I think may be of interest to you. First of all, this contracting program in 2014 resulted in approximately $47 million worth of contracted goods and services that were provided to all state and local public agencies. Local government accounted for over half of the spend, and that was about $25 million. State government, about half, and that was about $22 million. Services are the largest part of the contracts, and you'll see at the top of the page that janitorial services by far is the largest percentage of the contract work. Janitorial services accounted for a little over $31 million worth of contracts, and we would note that a large piece of that is the Portland Airport. Portland Airport is staffed by the Portland Habilitation Center, and that single contract is almost $20 million. So we were, I think, trying to give you some sense of what's an average contract look like, but there's such a range that we felt that an average was probably not a best type of number to offer you. Temporary staffing is another significant part of the services contracts, and last year that amounted to a little over $6 million. Temporary services is an interesting part of this work because that is where a disabled person is actually placed in a public government agency setting. They are actually going to do up to 6 months of temporary services work for any particular agency that places that order. One of the new pieces of work that we're quite pleased with is a technology support service that takes advantage of disabled individuals who have information technology skills. And ODOT, Department of Transportation, is the first agency to use this kind of service, and it's going very well. I think with that, I want to offer Darvin's opportunity now to give you further information, and then, of course, we're both available for questions.
Vice Chair Buehler, members of the committee, I'm Darvin Pierce, the QRF coordinator for the state, as Diane mentioned, and I really did appreciate all of the information Senator Gelser gave, as well as Diane's high-level synopsis of the information that is on that piece of paper. What I want to do in my presentation is walk through the PowerPoint presentation I hope you all have in front of you, and just really give you kind of a high-level view of what DAS's role, the Department of Administrative Services role, is in administering the QRF program. As Diane mentioned, DAS has been in charge of the program since its inception, and it's been pretty specifically laid at the feet of DAS to assure that the program runs effectively. So administration's been an interesting requirement right along. But just to let you know, the DAS's role, the real high-level part of DAS's role, is a qualified community rehabilitation program providers to be QRFs, to publish a list of products and services available through the program, to determine the price of all QRF products and services provided to public agencies through the program, to make rules, and to provide technical assistance to QRF providers and public agencies. The first part of that is qualifying QRF providers. Every year, QRF providers reapply to become a QRF, and they do that by showing that they meet the nonprofit, the requirements of being a nonprofit community rehabilitation program. They must serve individuals with disabilities, and they must provide employment services to Oregonians with disabilities, so much so that 75% of the employment that they provide throughout their entire organization must be by people with disabilities. And I need to clarify that developmental disabilities and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are not the only group of people who receive services through the program. People with mental illness, physical disabilities, physical impairment, visual impairment, and disabled veterans, and people who are served by vocational rehabilitation in other ways are also provided employment through the program. They must comply with every applicable health and safety requirement, and so that they can't have a bad rating by SAFE or by any other insurance organization saying that they're not giving people a safe place to work. They must meet the annual reporting requirements I mentioned earlier, which includes a report that DAS requires them to provide us with, and the information Diane was reporting actually comes from their reports. It also, they must, if they have sales through the program that exceed $100,000, they must obtain an independent CPA audit of their direct labor calculation to assure they're really employing people. 75% of the people, or the work, is being performed by people with disabilities that qualify. The second step of an a program that is being administered by DAS is to determine product and service suitability. As Diane mentioned, there's numerous, I think there's like 10 or 12 new products and services that are being provided through the program. That adds to the 18 products that are currently in the program and another 15 services spread throughout the entire state. As Diane mentioned, there's a map that you all probably have access to, I think, that should illustrate to you that this is a statewide program. There are organizations in every region of the state that has, not every region, but most regions of the state. I can't say that the southeastern corner has any QRFs, but everywhere else there is a representation of a QRF. In order for a QRF product or service to be found suitable, they must be in good standing in the program, and they must so have 75% direct labor by people with disabilities, meet all those other requirements. The product or service must meet a public agency need, and so it's important that a public agency really would need to buy whatever they're trying to provide. Workmanship must be consistent with that of the industry, the standard of the industry they're trying to move into, and if they are saying that they're going to provide janitorial services, they must have a track record showing that they are able to do that effectively. The product or service must meet the purpose of the program as well. In other words, it must provide employment for people with disabilities that meet that requirement. All products and services are posted to the procurement list, which, for your information, there is a link on the PowerPoint that should take you to the procurement list. We actually have an interactive database designed to facilitate public agency buyers' ability to actually get in and buy the products and services they need to purchase. The next step, and really the lion's share of the work that I perform, it seems like sometimes, is to determine the product and service prices throughout the QRF program. QRF and service pricing must recover costs, and this is key to know. If the costs for providing any product or service goes up, and for instance, if everybody were to have to pay minimum wage, then that would cause the public agencies to pay a price that recovers those costs for that QRF. So QRFs aren't going to be made to have any undue burden. The statute says that it will recover costs. So unless the statute changes in that regard, the prices will continue to do so. Pricing is developed using a computer-based Excel spreadsheet tool that we've developed at DAS. It effectively shows and is really an open book for anybody who wants to see how those costs are being transferred to the public agency. So if how much it costs in terms of product, in terms of materials, in terms of labor, in terms of overhead, all of those things are very well identified and must be demonstrated on that tool. Contracts are not competitively solicited, as Diane mentioned. They're directly awarded. So as a result, when a public agency buyer realizes they have a need that a QRF can meet, then they are required to approach that QRF and try to work with that QRF to develop a contract. Currently, there are over 550 state and local QRF contracts in the program, and those range from several hundred to the one that Diane mentioned with the Port of Portland. And so there's really do run the gamut. So with that, I guess I would just draw your attention to that map. Make sure that everybody does get a chance to look at that. And I don't have a copy of it here, else I'd hold it up. But you all have one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So good. And just to demonstrate the statewide nature of this program, as Diane mentioned, there are about 4,600 people who receive employment through qualified rehabilitation facilities currently. And with that, I'd welcome any questions for either myself or Diane.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair Buehler. So, Mr. Pierce, when you talk about that the QRFs are supposed to recover costs, do you take into account, the loss of value that you get for recyclables that you could sell on the open market? So, like, for instance, the state generates some waste paper, and that has a certain value. So when you turn that over to a QRF, I it's my understanding that the QRF doesn't pay for the value of that, but that's donated to the QRF. Do you take that into account then as a recovering cost?
Chair Buehler, Rep. Nierman, Representative Nierman, yes, indeed. It is considered part of their what they're being paid to provide that service. So if they're able to recover and their costs, what they get from paper, for instance, is pretty volatile. So they are using that to fund the cost of providing that service, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Buehler. So how are the wages determined for sub-minimum wage employees that are working out of QRFs? Who makes that determination, and how is it made?
Chair Buehler, Representative Nierman, indeed, the 14C certificate that I believe Senator Gelser mentioned actually has some very specific requirements about how those wages are determined when those wages are being paid for an individual who earns less than minimum wage. And many of the QRFs, and I wouldn't say this as broadly as all QRFs, but many of the QRFs allow individuals with disabilities to earn as much as that indicates they will earn. And they may earn better than 100% productivity wages and whatnot. But what they'll do is they'll do a survey of the wages paid for very similar types of businesses in the area for very similar types of work. And they use that information to determine a base rate. And then they evaluate how long it would take to do whatever it is they're being paid to do and pay according to that productivity against what a person without a disability would, how long it would take them to do it versus what that individual, how long it took that individual to do that same work. So there's a comparison there. They come up with a ratio. That ratio applies against that base wage, if you will.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Buehler. So DAS doesn't have any participation in that calculation. So it's the QRF that's making that determination.
Chair Buehler, Representative Nierman, yes, indeed. The QRF is required to pay in a legal way. They cannot, and as a result of obtaining a 14C certificate or paying people according to what may be a minimum wage, yes, they're required to meet those requirements that are stipulated by the Department of Labor and other agencies that regulate that sort of thing. So,
thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Oh, sure, Representative Colby.
Thanks. Do you have have any data on what the percentage of labor in these public contracts are performed with 14C designations?
Vice Chair Buehler, Representative Holvey, Darvin and I have been working mightily in the last several weeks to try to gather that information. And I know the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, which you will probably also hear from this afternoon, has also been trying to gather that. We do not today have a final tote up. What we do know is that there's no even pattern across the facilities. Every facility is unique. Some facilities use this type of 14C labor much more fully or often than others do. And so we've noted that. And so we hope to have some better information to offer because we know that you need it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'd like to call Bob Junda up for his testimony on the QRFs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. I've been tasked with just addressing two small issues. And so I'm not going to take it upon myself to take on the broader issue. I'd also like to just, in the spirit of full admission, Disability Rights Oregon is one of the law firms that is representing the plaintiffs in the case that Senator Gelser noted. And so whatever bias you want to take from that
duly noted
is appropriate. Although that case does not affect QRFs directly, even though it does affect the question of subminimum wage and sheltered workshops. So the two points that I've been asked to address today have to do with a new federal Executive Order 13658 issued by President Obama, having to do with requirement that minimum wage be paid in all federal contracting, with some small exceptions. And the one provision of that executive order that I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention, and I've provided you with some written materials that if they haven't gotten to you yet, they will, under that executive order, the 14C certificates that you've been hearing about will no longer be recognized in terms of the payment of minimum wage. So the people with disabilities cannot be paid under a 14C certificate in federal contracting. They will be required to receive the minimum wage. And this is reflective of the fact that there is a broad movement in federal policy and in the more progressive states to recognize that people with disabilities are like other human beings, and when they put in a full day's of work, they're entitled to a full day of pay and not to be treated as a minority, if you will, for a special type of wage treatment. The second item that I wanted to bring to your attention is that back in 1999, there was a bill passed by Congress called the Ticket to Work and Work Incentives Improvement Act of 1999. And in the area of disabilities and employment of people with disabilities, this was a very significant act because it changed the way of thinking about employment of those individuals. And the way that I would put it simply is traditionally, under federal law, you could be in two categories. You could either be a person who was able-bodied and ready to work, and or you could qualify for Social Security disability or SSI, and then you were considered to be completely disabled and never able to work again. And there's sort of these two categories. What the Ticket to Work Act did was it recognized that, in fact, many people who have disabilities that significantly affect their ability to work can be productive. And with the proper supports and services and opportunities that they can get out of what is, in fact, a poverty income situation, which is where Social Security disability laws leave you if that's your sole source of income, and work and augment their wages and resources, and oftentimes work their way back into the regular workforce. And so some programs are put into place in order to help them do that. And one of those is called Work Incentives Planning and Assistance. And what that does is it's a program that offers people with disabilities counseling in order to understand the effects of going back to work, the effects of doing that have on their benefits. And Disability Rights Oregon is one of 95 recipients around the country that operates what they're called WIPA programs, work incentive programs, in order to give people the information and tools that they need to understand how they can return to work without unduly jeopardizing their benefits, and to have the ability to do it in a thoughtful way and in a way that can make sure that should they have difficulties in returning to work, that they have a safety net, if you will. And so there are three primary parts of the program and the Social Security offers to help people who want to return to work. And one is called the trial work period that allows people to go back to work, give it a try, do as many hours as they can, while sustaining their benefits for a period of time. So that just going back to work does not mean you automatically lose the benefits that you need. The second thing is a program that's called expedited reinstatement, so that, again, if a person's working, they're moving out of Social Security, or they've lessened their dependence on Social Security, that if they lose their job or there's some other problem, their disability prevents them from being as productive as they were, that they can immediately get back onto those benefits so that they're not at risk. And then there are other provisions that allow a person to return back to benefits without having to go through lengthy reevaluations of their condition. So there's some assurances, if you will, for that individual that, gee, if I go back to work and I do my best and for some reason I am unable to sustain that, that I don't all of a sudden have to go back through the 2 and 3 year process it's necessary to get evaluated and determined eligible for Social Security. So I just wanted to make the committee aware of those particular programs, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Thank you very much, Bob. Next up, Nan Heim from Oregon Rehabilitation Association. Nan? Oh, and also Ryan Fisher, would you like to come up?
Thank you, Chair Buehler, Vice Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Our association and our members' activities and employment go back half a century, when most individuals with developmental disabilities were still institutionalized, and parents began exploring options to institutionalization, and they formed local programs that had activities and sometimes training and eventually jobs. And these programs got together in 1967 and organized our association. Today, our primary members are 49 nonprofit organizations throughout the state that provide jobs and housing to Oregonians with disabilities. Our members include organizations that serve people in all of your districts: Southern Oregon Aspire, Pearl Buck, the Opportunity Foundation of Central Oregon, Cornerstone Associates, Mid Valley Rehabilitation, and Edwards Center and TVW in Washington County. All of these organizations are qualified rehabilitation facilities, and all of them have, to one degree or another, some sheltered workshops. If you and I know they're not the same thing, and I'm very grateful that Senator Gelser explained that. If you have not visited one of these programs, you would be so welcome to do so, and I think that you would find it useful. 21 of our 49 member organizations have met the requirements to be designated as qualified rehabilitation facilities under Oregon Products of Individuals with Disabilities Law. I just want to mention, and it is especially poignant this week to do this, that the chief sponsor of the Products of Individuals with Disabilities Law that created this program was then State Representative Dave Frohnmeyer in 1979. You heard the estimate that approximately 4,500 Oregonians with a wide range of disabilities are employed with qualified rehabilitation facilities because of this law. We are very proud of this, but it is absolutely just a drop in the bucket. The unemployment rate for Oregonians with disabilities comes close to 68%. Behind these numbers are thousands of personal stories. And one of them, I think you have the written testimony that was submitted for me online. It's very long because I think all 49 members had a chance to submit something and add to it. And I'm not going to read it, but there is a wonderful picture and a story there about a woman in one of the qualified rehabilitation facilities and in a sheltered workshop. Her name is Donzella. I hope you'll look at her picture. Her story is very moving. She came to Salem about 25 years ago. and her behavioral problems were so challenging that she actually was brought here in a cage, which is very hard to believe, from Eastern Oregon, from an institution. Initially, she couldn't work at all, but over the years, with training and as she became used to relating to people and to coworkers, she was able to work. She now works 5 hours a day. And she, according to the people who work with her, the staff who've worked with her for a long time, she loves her job and she loves having a payday. It can be very challenging to find jobs for people with disabilities, especially the wide range of disabilities that Darvin explained to you. But I am continually impressed by the diligence and the creativity of the staff at these programs in finding jobs for the people with disabilities. They run bakeries. Cornerstone has a bakery in downtown Corvallis. They make safety vests for ODOT, which is, by the way, one of the best state agencies at reaching out to work with people with disabilities. One of our programs actively fills temporary positions with state agencies. I want to share just a few facts about how qualified rehabilitation facilities in our association function. They are, first of all, nonprofits. They are employers. They must also be training facilities, and that is a requirement. I think you've heard how you qualify to be employed by one of these facilities. You need proof of disability. You can get that from many sources. You can get that from a physician or another medical professional or a mental health professional or the State Commission for the Blind, the Department of Human Services, the Veterans Administration, etc. Any employer, not just a nonprofit, not just a qualified rehabilitation facility, can apply to the U.S. Department of Labor to obtain that 14C commensurate wage certificate. And those are the employers that are allowed to pay less than minimum wage if several conditions are met. And I think it was explained how that works, that you have to conduct the prevailing wage survey, and then you compare the productivity level of the worker without a disability to one with a disability and determine a percentage. I want to address a couple of the specific issues that have come up that surround qualified rehabilitation facilities. First, the minimum wage that Senator Gelser spoke so eloquently to, and then the former governor's executive order. And I want to emphasize this as strongly as I possibly can. Our members are not opposed to individuals with disabilities earning minimum wage. In fact, they work very hard to find minimum wage jobs for individuals with disabilities and jobs that pay more than minimum wage. They really want to do that. The concern that I've heard from them over and over again is if minimum wage is mandated for all employees of a qualified rehabilitation facility, what happens to those individuals with the most challenging disabilities and the least productivity? And I think this is where we have a difference of policy with Senator Gelser. We love daytime activities. I think she'll remember that 6 years ago we had to fight very passionately to get funding restored for them. Then Governor Kitzhaber's budget zeroed out funding for daytime activities. But we also feel that people with disabilities, even those who have very, very challenging disabilities and can work only a few hours a week, love their jobs. Senator Bates spoke to this very movingly the other day in Ways and Means, and he's a physician for many individuals with disabilities. He said, "I'm afraid the direction we're going in, we're going to take away any opportunity for them to work at all." And that is what our concern is and what I want to convey to you today. The other issue is, of course, the former governor's executive order for community integrated employment. Again, our concern is for those individuals with the most severe disabilities. The state actually has adopted a policy of lower rates paid to those programs that have individuals who are not yet placed in community employment. The problem for that is there are some programs that have, including Edwards Center, including Pearl Buck, that have a reputation for taking people with particularly significant disabilities. So they are getting squeezed by this policy. So these two issues, minimum wage, how do we take care of people with the most significant disabilities in with these issues, minimum wage and integrated community employment. Those are the ones that I think will require the most attention. We appreciate everything that Senator Gelser has done, and we appreciate the time that Representative Holvey has put in on this issue. It's complex, it's challenging, and it's very, very important. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nan. Let's hold questions for just a second and finish this round of testimony.
Thank you, Chair Buehler, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the Portland Habilitation Center, which is a QRF in the Portland area, but which serves counties around the state. I want to, first of all, give a disclaimer. While I represent Portland Habilitation Center, I've done so not nearly as long as Nan has represented ORA, and so my knowledge is not as deep. Chair Fagan had requested that I represent PHC today, and I love working with them, but I want to give that disclaimer. If I misstate something, I promise I will go back and correct any mistakes, but I just wanted to give that disclaimer before I began. Portland Habilitation Center's mission is to provide employment opportunities for people with disabilities and to advocate for people with disabilities. We are both a QRF and a 14C certificate holder. One thing that is perhaps unique about our QRF is that our employees are represented by three labor unions, SEIU Local 49, Laborers Local 483, and OPEIU Local 4873. PHC actually sought out union representation for their employees many years ago as a strategy to provide health care for their employees. And what it has done is it has meant that our employees all earn not just minimum wage, but prevailing wage, with the exception, which I will get to in a moment, one exception. As I mentioned, or as has already been stated today, in fact, as everybody's testified, I've been scratching off all the things that I was thinking I might need to say because everybody said it so much better than I would. But we meet all of the requirements, the 75% of the workforce. And one of the things that is very important to us is that priority for state contracts and government contracts. It's an incredibly important tool for providing employment opportunities. I'd like to give a little bit of history about our 14C certificate. Portland Habilitation Center's history goes back several decades, and at that time, when it started, it was a school because Portland Public Schools would not accept students with disabilities. And so parents got together and created this nonprofit entity to be a school. As the first class graduated, then those same parents, similar to the story Nan just told, said, okay, so what's next? How do we provide an opportunity for folks to continue to be engaged? And that's when the transition to providing work began. As Portland Public Schools began accepting people with disabilities, that portion of the mission went away, and PHC began to focus on employment opportunities. What we have is what we call our legacy class, and we have a group of individuals who were that first graduating class who have continued to work together and still to this day are working together. And I invite all of you, Representative Holvey has had an opportunity to come and tour the facility. I would extend that invitation to all of you. They are all at about retirement age. We have not added any new employees to that 14C certificate in many, many years and don't have an intention of doing so. What we have found is that by setting this high wage standard, by having these wages that are negotiated with the unions, it puts the incentive on us to create supportive work environments and very high-quality training that allows the productivity to be high enough that we can meet all of the needs of the organizations for whom we provide services and still provide this this good wage to the folks who are working with us. That said, we still have some concerns about some potential unintended consequences of a minimum wage floor. And I think nearly all of those have been pieced out, but I want to say one specific piece that I haven't quite heard today, which is that, you know, we've talked about the calculation and how things are done. In a few cases where you have, as Nan had referred to, folks with more severe disabilities, perhaps a number of them together, that are working at a low percentage of the person without disabilities. That would make a significant increase in wages across each of them, which would significantly increase the cost to the QRF of fulfilling the contract. As I understand it, and I'm happy to be corrected by Darvin, but when they set their standards for what a service may cost, if the QRF's costs are above that, then they are not eligible for that contract. And so that's where we see this pinch, and it's in a few cases, but if you get in this pinch, then the QRF or the 14C certificate holder has to do one of two things. They have to either lose the contract, in which case then perhaps there are a number of different outcomes for all of the folks who are working at that QRF, or they have to have people with less severe disabilities work in order to bring themselves within that limitation of the contract. And so that is the pinch that we see, and it's the concern that we have. It would not affect PHC, but again, part of our mission is to advocate for people with disabilities. And I think Senator Gelser spoke very eloquently that we have to manage a transition, and our concern is that if the state goes in this direction, chooses this policy direction, that this is the situation that must be addressed and must be looked into. So we've worked over the interim with Representative Holvey on trying to find some ways of drawing that line, because we think there are some people who would benefit from minimum wage, who are getting slightly below. And we want to get all of the good without having this bad. So,
Ryan, I hate to interrupt you, but we have one more person.
I was just about to wrap up, so thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Maybe a couple quick questions. We have one more person who's hoping to testify on this informational meeting.
I just have one, and it's one I can throw out, and then you can get me an answer or something. You know, talking about dealing with the transition from a program that worked, and we want to make it work even better. The two things that came to mind was, first of all, on this productivity matrix for the for your organizations that are 14C, are they testing the productivity with or without support for the worker? Is it without support for the worker, or in an atmosphere or a setting where support is actually given to the worker?
I will go ahead and volunteer to get back to you.
Yeah,
on
get back
that.
To me. And then the second one was also there. You've talked about a group of folks that are severe in their handicapped skills, and I would want to know the definition of severe, and then also the percentage that you would say are part of that workforce.
Thank you, Ben.
If I could.
Briefly, please.
Representative McLean, it's my understanding of those 4,500 that are employed because of this law that 500 of them, up to no more than that, receive less than minimum wage because of their productivity and severe disabilities.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one more person here. Andrea Salinas.
Good afternoon, Chair Buehler, Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the contract lobbyist for SEIU Local 49. Combined with SEIU Local 503, SEIU is the largest union in the state of Oregon, representing 65,000 public and private employees. SEIU 49 represents approximately 600 janitors at Portland Habilitation Center. That's 600 out of the 4,000 QRF employees. Of those 600, all 600 receive prevailing wages. The SEIU employees who work for the Portland Habilitation Center are paid prevailing wages and are paid on time, but QRFs aren't required to pay even minimum wage, much less prevailing wage. Not all QRFs are created equal, and there's a perennial problem which SEIU faces. Frequently, QRF employees are ask SEIU to help recover owed wages in addition to seeking help over other labor violations. And the last time that this happened was back in 2013, where employees of Diversified Abilities, a QRF providing janitorial services in Portland, were being given draw checks. And I don't know if you know what those are. They're essentially IOUs in lieu of paychecks. These employees with disabilities were uncertain of where to turn when they had a problem, so they turned to SEIU, where they knew there was a union. And these employees were basically unclear how to navigate the bully process. They knew there was a bully process, they just didn't know how to navigate it. At the time this QRF was shortchanging its employees of owed wages, it was bringing in over $1 million in gross revenues and paying the director and her spouse $178,000 combined. The state's largest QRF, Portland Habilitation Center, brings in around $27 million annually in gross revenue and pays its CEO the same, around $178,000. It was a pretty common tactic for this unscrupulous QRF to ask its employees to meet at a certain location, in a different location, every week or every couple of weeks or every 3 weeks, at a given time to pick up the paychecks, only for management to avoid delivery of those paychecks altogether. It should go without saying that this sort of mismanagement and direct violation of wage and labor is not only illegal, but it's morally reprehensible for these employees. It's QRFs like Diversified Abilities and the lawsuits on the sheltered workshops here in Oregon, and I might say across the country. I think Senator Gelser mentioned that Vermont doesn't have 14C, and we're seeing changes happening in Rhode Island and all over the country that motivate SEIU and should motivate the legislature to start taking preemptive action and work toward improving workplace conditions and increasing the wages for these workers. SEIU believes there are a number of steps that can be taken to help these workers, and it could go a long way to improving that transition process that Senator Gelser talked about. Currently, QRF workers on a public agency service contract may only be making minimum wage. QRF workers on product contracts may be making even less than the minimum wage. QRF workers on these public contracts have a broad range of abilities and are providing important services. Like we just heard, some are working on ODOT contracts, different janitorial contracts to the state of Oregon, and we believe that they deserve their fair compensation for the work that they do. It's not any less valuable than the work that you and I do. As a union, we would strongly encourage paying these workers the local prevailing wage. There's currently no formal oversight mechanism to ensure QRFs are complying with applicable wage and hour laws, civil rights laws, occupational health and safety standards, other than the existing processes for filing a complaint. Workers with disabilities have access to the various processes for filing complaints with BOLI and OSHA, but like I just mentioned, they really have a difficult time trying to navigate that process. The challenges workers with disabilities face in reporting workplace violations can mask the operations of bad actors in the industry, and workplace abuses can persist for years without meaningful state action. SEIU would suggest putting in place a BOLI audit. This audit could be triggered when the commissioner receives two or more complaints in a year from a QRF worker, and the commissioner could make the results of these audits available to the Department of Administrative Services. And further, a QRF that violates wage requirements more than three times in a year could be removed from the procurement list of qualified agencies. Workers with disabilities are profoundly impacted and have a difficult time adjusting to a new work environment when their QRF employer loses a public contract through no fault of the workers. We would like to see a worker retention policy in place It would provide a critical component of protecting workers from poorly managed contractors. SEIU would suggest establishing a worker retention policy for QRF and their workers in the event a public agency terminates a contract with one QRF in favor of another QRF. Under the policy, the new QRF would be required to offer employment to the workers, and they would have a right of first refusal. The new QRF would still be allowed to require workers hired under this provision to undergo its standard hiring procedure and probationary period. Under current statute, public agencies are currently required to first attempt to fulfill public contracts from the state list of QRFs if there's an available QRF capable of providing the needed goods and services. Problems arise when the only QRF option may be one that doesn't provide its workers with adequate wages and benefits, not PHC, or is one that has racked up multiple bully complaints. SEIU would actually recommend, and we think this could be a good part of this kind of transition process, to see an opt-out of the QRF procurement list if the only available QRF has violated payment of those prevailing wages. Further, the public agency could be allowed to opt out if an alternative non-QRF contractor offered employment to those employees of the QRF that the public agency would have contracted with otherwise. SEIU would just like you to take some of these recommendations and think about it as a necessary transition. We think that a lot of the things that we're facing right now with the executive order, with the changes happening across the nation, as pretty inevitable, but vital to the success of these employees and integral to our state. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Salinas?
And she'll also be back on Tuesday for the public hearings on the bill. So, since we're a little bit close to time. So, all right, thank you very much.
You.
And with that, I'm going, that's the last person. Yeah. I'm going to close the informational hearing on qualified rehabilitation facilities. And very quickly, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2258. Wendy, do you want to give it a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. House Bill 2258 prevents insurers from considering individuals' driving record when determining rates for personal insurance policies, except in specified circumstances when an insurer may consider an abstract of non-employment driving record. It applies to insurance policies issued or renewed on or after their effective day. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendments for the bill.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2258 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Mulvey?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative Nearman?
Aye.
Stark?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Buehler? Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
Chair Fagan? Yes. And is anyone in particular like to carry this? Representative Buehler, do you want to carry this one?
I'll be happy to.
All right. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2258. And since we're over time, I'm going to just go ahead and close the Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee. Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee.